The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by One-Click Upsell from Zipify Apps. And I love One-Click Upsell because it offers an incredible amount of bang for the buck. If you get the app, it's simple enough and powerful enough that you can get it set up and get running in an hour or two, get those upsells in front of your customers. And in return, one in six of your customers are going to spend more with you because one in six people who are offered an upsell through One-Click Upsell actually take it. And that's money that just flows instantly without having to spend more on advertising, without having to go through painful, expensive, timely CRO processes. This is something you can set up and start seeing the fruits of right away. They've helped generate over $150 million in additional revenue for Shopify merchants just like you. So if that sounds interesting, you can learn more about One-Click Upsell and get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is sponsored by Klaviyo, the leading e-commerce marketing solution for email and SMS trusted by over 50,000 merchants. Why? Because they have a pretty amazing segmentation and customization engine built in to their marketing platform. It lets you send messages based on what your customers have done, what pages they've visited, how much they've spent with you, how much they're likely to spend with you over time with their very cool LTV prediction tool, what products they've purchased or haven't purchased. It's pretty incredible. And in a world where email inboxes are only getting more crowded, people are getting more ruthless, sending highly targeted messages is the only way you're going to be able to cut through the noise. And you can do that with Klaviyo. So if you want to make more money from your flows, from your efforts on email and SMS, check them out. You can start for free at klaviyo.com/ECF. That's klaviyo.com/ECF. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven-figure plus e-commerce brands build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And at least in the case of this episode, potentially exit those businesses for life-changing sometimes exits, which is where a lot of times, as you know, a big portion of wealth is created for entrepreneurs. And joining me to talk about that is Joe Valley. He is the author of The Entrepreneur's Playbook, as well as a longtime business broker with Quiet Life Brokerage. And I've known him for years and years. Great, honest, knowledgeable guy. He's helped a lot of ECF members exit their business. And we're talking about, you know, taking his knowledge from, you know, over a decade of doing this, dealing with hundreds of transactions, hundreds and hundreds, and talking about how you can set up a business to really sell for top dollar, not just when you decide to sell, but in the years before that, because it makes a huge difference if you have that perspective in terms of how many people want your business and how much you get for it. So we kick it off quickly, just talking about the market circa, you know, middle of 2021 right now. It's interesting times with general market, FBA businesses, and then dive into a lot of the specifics about valuation, ad backs. I thought the ad back discussion was really interesting. There were some ad back things I had never considered that could help you get more for a business, and cover a lot of really good stuff. So hope you enjoy it. And with that said, let's go ahead and jump into my discussion with Joe. Joe, welcome to the podcast, sir. Good to have you on. And especially given just, I feel like what's been a really good relationship with you, with Quiet Light, with the team over there over the years. It's hard to find brokers that know their stuff, that are reputable, that add a lot of value, and you feel good putting your name behind. And yeah, all those things I can say confidently about yourself and the team over at Quiet Light. So yeah, pleasure to have you on and talk, and excited to dig into some geeky stuff about buying and selling businesses. So welcome.
Appreciate it, man. Glad to be here. I think back to the first time that I met you personally, and I think we were in Nashville at one of your events in some giant green interior auditorium and lots of plants everywhere. And I can't remember the name of the place, but I think that was the first one. And I was such an introvert at the time. Like, we were sponsoring it, and you were getting up and speaking and introducing me, and I was too afraid to show up to that lunch. And you're like, oh, there's Joe. I came afterwards. And it's funny because now any time I go to ECF, I'm just visiting old friends. And that's just the way it should be. And I'm happy to be part of it.
Crazy. See, that surprises me. See, you don't strike me as an introvert. I would never have guessed that just being out and talking to you. And you know, but I think there's probably a lot of introverts, you know, myself to some degree, that hide it well and make the bet, you know, just kind of get out there and do it. But that's crazy. I would not have guessed that.
No, that's why I sneak up to my room at 9:30 at night instead of being down in the lobby until 11:30 talking to anybody. It's exhausting.
That's why it's Mark that's always just going crazy, and we have to rein him in at 2:30 in the morning. Yeah, and okay,
right. This more like Chuck, but yeah,
more like Chuck. Well, Joel, I want to start with kind of diving into the current state of e-commerce stores. Get a market pulse from you on where we're at. We're recording this late July 2021. And we're kind of coming out of COVID fairly strongly. That had a bunch of implications for e-commerce. But give us a sense of what's the e-commerce market look like for, if you're looking to sell an e-commerce business or buy one. Yeah, what are the high points, the bullets that people would be interested in knowing?
Well, if we go back to 2016, I think when we were in Savannah together, you got up on stage, talked about, Amazon versus, revenue from your own URL. And I think at that time, 75% of the people said that 80+% was from their own store, not Amazon. And then a few years later, it was the reverse. We're definitely seeing that. And back in 16, we used to round down the multiples, right? So instead of, a 2.75 multiple, which online rounds up to 2.8, I would literally list it at 2.74. So it rounds down to a 2.7 because that's how sensitive buyers were 5 years ago. They were very, very sensitive to multiples because the online business world was still relatively new and it wasn't accepted as a, safe form of business and safe investment and for a solid return on investment. Fast forward 5 years, we don't have enough businesses to sell. There are many more buyers than there are sellers, and the multiples have gone up substantially. We've had an average of 4.5 offers on every listing. Year to date, take it back. I just brought it up again. It's with 4 offers on every listing. 43% are going above asking, 15 at asking, and 40% very close to asking, but just below. There's many more buyers than there are sellers, which is great for sellers because the multiples are definitely getting pushed up and the deal structures are better as well, especially from the aggregators. They used to be horrible deal structures. Now they're only so-so. They're not as horrible, but there's enough of them competing against each other that not only are they paying more, but the deal structures are better too. That's a good place to be as a seller.
Yeah. Let's dive into a little bit of both of those individually. Talk about multiples. Let's start out with, what are you seeing for multiples? And let's use just for the sake of argument, let's use a business that's, let's say, maybe making $500K in seller's discretionary earnings. Maybe doing $2 or $3 million in top line sales. And let's say they have a 50-50 split between Amazon and their own site. Like what's an average multiple you're seeing right now for something like that?
I would say it's going to start at 4 at least, right? So it's a 4-time multiple of seller's discretionary earnings. That excludes inventory, right? The only ones that include inventory are website closers. I just want to make that clarification. So, you're looking at least $2 million for that type of company, probably more. And I'm talking about bottom line. Right? That's the low end. I would easily put it safely in a comfortable range of 4 to 5 times. If you've got $500,000 in discretionary earnings, 50-50 split between Amazon and your own Shopify store. The Shopify store part of it used to be 10 to 15% more valuable than just an FBA business, but we're seeing the FBA businesses come up more. So it's a nice healthy balance, but easily in that four to five time range, I'd say.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but even 3 years ago, that probably would have been 3.25 to 3.5. Is that lower? Have the multiples gone up that much?
3 years ago, yeah, three to 3.5 probably. Yeah, it's just changed dramatically. I mean, people have gray hair now. We're older. We're adults. We're running real businesses, and investors believe that and have seen it and are buying them and putting them in a portfolio and immediately getting an 8-time multiple because of the size and depth of the business portfolio versus that individual business. So multiples have definitely gone up simply because of competition and because of people's belief in the legitimacy of online businesses and the growth that is in the future, right? The pandemic changed things. You and I have been working remotely for decades, right? Now everybody can work remotely and they see the ability to operate a business remotely. Run an online business, make it real, make it successful. And not just in the revenue that it produces and, for their own, cash flow, but also for the eventual exit as well.
Yeah. What about, let's take that same business and let's say instead of making 50-50 split, let's say instead of doing 2 million top line, maybe 500K on the bottom, let's say they're doing, you know, somewhere between 8 and 10 top line. Let's say they're netting a mil and a half seller's discretionary earning, EBITDA, however you want to say it. What is that? You said before when we were below, you know, 500K SDE, you're probably looking at 4.5x multiple on that earnings. How much does earnings jump once you kind of cross that threshold? And is that threshold still about that $1 million SDE / EBITDA / earnings mark?
Yeah. And keep in mind that the threshold in dollars is just one marker, right? It's one benchmark in terms of the overall value of the business. If you've got that business that's doing 1.5 in discretionary earnings and it has one SKU and all the revenue is driven by Facebook, you're not going to get a 5x multiple. Right? There's just too much risk there because it's a hero SKU and Facebook is pretty shaky these days or for a while now. So you've got to look at all of the different aspects of the business. No two businesses are created equal. These valuation ranges based upon discretionary earnings or ballpark ranges, you have to then drill down into the type of business that it is, the risks, the growth, the opportunities, the transferability, the documentation, all of these things. Who runs the business, right? That fifth pillar, the people behind it. That all goes into the value. But if you want to say 1.5 million in discretionary, 50-50, you know, a nice balance of SKUs, good growth opportunities, I would probably start it at least 5, right? Now you're bumping up at least 5x discretionary earning.
What about, you mentioned FBA businesses. Amazon, I feel like we've seen, at least in our community with sellers I've talked to, there's still a lot of opportunity on Amazon, but it's also, you know, more cutthroat than it was a couple of years ago. There's a lot more FBA aggregators out there and roll-up companies right now. Thrasio, you know, among one of the most well-known ones. It seemed like 2 years ago, there was just an insatiable appetite for those, with people not really thinking about the risk as much. Is that still the case today? Has the appetite for FBA businesses cooled off at all, or is it still as hot as ever?
Hot as ever. We just don't have enough of them. Mark was just at the Prosper show, and he said all the booths were aggregators and brokers. It seemed like 50% of the booths there were aggregators and brokers, which is great for sellers of Amazon businesses. But if they don't get the training that they need to understand how to calculate sellers' discretionary earnings, they're going to, you know, provide a nice ignorance discount to the aggregators, meaning they're ignorant, don't know how to do an AVEX schedule, and sell the business at a discount. That's the biggest problem I see with the aggregators, is that they're buying these businesses with a nice sales pitch, right? They reach out to the broker, hey, love what you're doing. We actually just got on a business called Amazing Aces. Paul Anderson sold that business to Matt Howitt, and we've talked about this on the podcast. Paul now is an advisor with QuietLight. Well, one of the aggregators reached out to Paul and said, "Gosh, I just love what you've done with Amazing Aces. We could, you know, bring this into our portfolio. We'll pay you, you know, I think the multiple is like a 5x multiple. We'll match anybody else's offer. Plus, we'll give you $250,000. Doesn't that sound too good to be true? It is too good to be true. So they've got nice sales pitches that are really complimentary to the business owner, flattery. Unfortunately, it's a sales pitch and none of it's really true. That same aggregator that made that pitch and put it in Paul's inbox and then we all got it, we're working with now. All they do is nickel and dime and due diligence. And we just want to say, hey, we want to, can we add that $250,000 on now? Because that's what you're telling everybody. I really want to help educate the business owners, whether they've been part of e-commerce fuel for a decade and are really, really, you know, connected and understand these things very well, or if it's somebody new, because these little nuances can make a difference, you know, from sleeping at night after the transaction closes or paying for your kid's college tuition if you don't get an ad back right. The FBA side of things is just absolutely crazy right now. There are so many buyers for them that individual buyers are struggling to find one because most of the aggregators are eating them up.
Interesting. You've got this really interesting view into the business world that almost no one has in terms of the number of deals you see, the number of transactions you see. And you don't just get to see, you know, a lot of people see decks, you know, like I see a decent number of decks for deals and look at them. But you get to walk with some of these sellers for months at a time, sometimes years over years and years, see their business. But you also get to see something which I think is really interesting, which is kind of behind the curtain of what their life looks like, whether it's through just, you know, subtle things you pick up on conference calls or them outright telling you or the reasons for they sell the business. You are able to connect how a business is doing, how financially successful it is, with the quality of life to some degree that a business owner has. And so given that amazingly rare perspective you have, do you have, you know, if you had to go out and buy like the perfect size e-commerce business, the ideal balance of like financial reward, fulfillment, freedom, not just hating your life, what type, like what size, I guess what, maybe it's not even e-commerce, like what type and size of business would you buy of all the ones that you see? I think it's a really interesting question and you've got an interesting, you know, very unique perspective on it.
Yeah. I would want it to be sizable first and foremost because it's going to be less risk, right? I don't want to buy a $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 business because that's, you know, 18 to 24 months old. It's small. There's a lot of work to do left. There's no systems in place or SOPs that I can just run with. I don't want that grind, right? I've been self-employed since 1997. I'm done grinding it out. So if it were me personally, I would buy something in the, you know, $1.5 to $5 million range.
And when you say that, do you mean purchase price? You mean revenue or?
Purchase price.
Purchase price. Okay.
Purchase price. Yeah. Let's see, if it was $1 million purchase price, I'd translate that into probably $1 million in revenue, right? Because there's probably going to be $300,000, $250,000, $300,000 in discretionary earnings. So, you know, if it was a $2 million business, there's probably $500,000 to $600,000 in discretionary earnings. If we go that 20% rule, right? 15 to 20% discretionary earnings. But I'd buy something bigger. I'd want, if it was going to be, if it was going to be an e-commerce business, right, selling a physical product, I would want a hell of a brand. I would want great growth opportunities that I didn't have to rush to do. I would want to be slow and steady with a nice plan. But ideally, for me, I think a sizable content business might make a whole lot of sense with, you know, writers and processes in place and stuff that isn't tied to the latest soap opera, right? So we're not having to, you know, put content out every single day. I would want content going out, you know, once or twice a month, good solid content that readers eat up and that type of thing. Something a little bit more consistent, slow and steady and winning in the long run versus in the next 12 months. Because for me, the win would be in the eventual exit. That's the way I'd look at it. It wouldn't be in, you know, the cash flow from the business. It would be in the next exit.
As I mentioned at the top, you wrote a book called Extrapreneur's Playbook. Fantastic book. Just got done reading it. That highlights really the whole process of more or less your, you know, decades plus of experience selling and, you know, helping people buy and sell businesses into book. It's a great primer if you've never done it before, or if you have. I picked up a bunch of stuff in here as well that I thought was super valuable. And one of the things that you said in this book that was the biggest mistake that caused problems with the sale was bookkeeping. Talk about that a little bit. Like what are the mistakes people make with bookkeeping that hold up a sale?
Well, first of all, we're entrepreneurs, so we think we can do anything, right? That's our badge of honor and our affliction. It's a problem. Most of us are not CPAs or bookkeepers. And let me just clarify the difference between the two. CPAs do your tax returns. Bookkeepers provide accurate profit and loss statements on a monthly basis. So bookkeeping is where people definitely make mistakes. First and foremost, for an e-commerce business, they're doing cash accounting instead of accrual. And actually, if I back up, they're not using QuickBooks or Xero, which is stunning. It's getting better. I'm seeing less and less businesses that are doing $2 or $3 million in revenue that are using an Excel spreadsheet. I guarantee you people listening to this are using an Excel spreadsheet, just ballpark tracking stuff. That doesn't work.
You mentioned bookkeepers, and I feel like finding good bookkeepers that understand accounting is hard, and I've got a few, but who do you recommend? Like if you had to throw out a couple of names for people to connect with, that, you know, bookkeepers that just do great accounting and understand and get e-commerce, that get the difficulties of figuring out COGS with inventory and all that kind of stuff, who do you recommend?
It's a challenge, I'll tell you that right now. I've got these listed under the resources page on exitpreneur.io, but CapForge, Care, CPA, Catching Clouds, MuseMinded, Seller Accountant, Bottom Line CPA. There's six of them right there. Some do Xero, some do QuickBooks, some will do both. Some will only deal with companies that are doing, you know, $2.5-3 million in revenue. Others happy to work with smaller ones.
You talk about these four pillars of valuation, the four things that really determine how much your business is worth. And we're going to give this in a minute. But the one I thought that was the most interesting was this fifth pillar you talked about. And it's very intangible. It's very abstract, but it has a huge impact on, the value you get for the business, the number of people are willing to buy. Can you talk about what's the fifth pillar that you mentioned? And because I found this one the most fascinating.
Yeah. It's funny. I refer to them as pillars, but the title of that chapter is What Buyers Want. And it's, focusing on those four different pillars and the invisible fifth one. Mark, who you know well, my business partner, says, Joe, there's no fifth pillar. there kind of is. So there's growth, defensibility, transferability, documentation. These are the primary four pillars. The fifth is the person behind the business. It's the mortar that keeps these pillars together. And time again, I've seen sellers that add more value just because of who they are and the way they behave. And I've seen sellers lose more value because of who they are and how they behave. An extreme example, a business that I personally had listed for sale. It was a good business, very attractive, great margins, well-aged, very diversified. But I get an email from a potential buyer that says, hey, Joe, is so-and-so this person? And he shared a link with me. And then he wrote, if he is, I have no interest in buying the business. Turns out the person was a registered sex offender when he was 20 years old. He had a younger encounter with an encounter, according to him, somebody that was 17 years old or something like that. He didn't let me know that in advance. And I didn't, at that time, do background checks on people the way that I do them now. But that buyer just said, look, I don't want to deal with that type of individual. I'm just going to assume the worst. And I don't want anything to do with that person or the business. So eroded right there. On the other side of things, an older gentleman named John that I sold the business for, and it was a content site. And it was back when multiples, were not breaking that 2.74 mark. He was doing about $400,000 a year in discretionary earnings, traveling the world with his business, right? Because he would travel the world and do trivia from where he was in the world, and he'd make revenue, from affiliates and things of that nature. And he was just so damn likable, Andrew. I wanted to be his friend, right? And he was, 74, 75 years old at the time. And I told him, look, man, buyers are afraid of anything above 2.74 at this time in the market. He's like, just get me on the phone with them, and we'll get it sold for more. He wanted a four-time multiple when four-time multiples were not doable. The business obviously had to be strong. And I had so much confidence in him because he was likable and trustworthy, not because he was good at selling. He was good at selling because he was likable and trustworthy, but he was not a salesperson. We had multiple offers on that at full price, and it sold. And I learned a great lesson there that the person behind the business is as valuable, if not more valuable, than the other four pillars put together.
Hey, Andrew here with a little aside. If you're listening, you're obviously interested in e-commerce. And so I want to make sure you know about our private community for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands at e-commerce fuel. And the secret sauce, like you might guess, is it's limited to people who own stores, who are in the trenches, practitioners doing this stuff. It's a very curated community, which has three big benefits. First, it means everyone inside can help get fast, on-point answers to your most important questions. If you're trying to decide if SMS is a tool worth rolling out, if you just got suspended on Amazon, if you're trying to hire a director of e-commerce, these are all things that either people have experience with or have gone through in the forums. And if you post and ask questions, you'll get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes, as well as being able to tap into close to a decade of archive discussions. So you get a lot of insights, fast answers to pressing questions. You get to plug into an amazing network of over 1,100 experienced e-commerce entrepreneurs. So you can reach out to people if you're in e-commerce fuel. Our members are incredibly giving and generous. And so if you want to reach out to someone with expertise, oftentimes we'd be happy to share what they know. If you're, traveling, hopefully when traveling is a common thing again, a lot of our members would hit in the city, DC, Dallas, Sydney, Australia, London, wherever it is, and be able to have someone on the ground you can connect with or maybe grab a beer with. It's an amazing network. And then finally, we've got a huge user-generated review library with over 10,000 reviews on agencies, software, e-commerce software that you can tap into to avoid costly hiring and software mistakes. Nothing is worse than spending 3 months with an agency to onboard only to find out that a bunch of people already tried them and they were horrible and they wasted a bunch of your money and your life. So those are the kind of things you can avoid tapping into the unbiased reviews and experiences of our members with our software directory. So if any of this sounds interesting to you, you should join us at ecommercefuel.com. You can learn more. You can apply for membership there. We also have a 5x ROI guarantee. If you own a 7 or 8 figure brand and your membership fees for our community don't pay for themselves at least 5 times over the course of the first year, we'll refund it completely as well as send you $1,000 just for the wasted time. So ecommercefuel.com, check it out. We'd love to have you apply and potentially join the community. All right, back to the discussion.
One of the sections I found most interesting was your section on ad backs. And if for people who weren't familiar, an ad back is something that if you're selling a business, it's an expense that you had that the new buyer likely will not have. So potentially you expense a trip that is business related, but it's maybe you wouldn't have taken it just on your own, you know, for the business sake. It wasn't mandatory, but it was largely a personal trip as well, but had some business relations or any other one-time expenses that were one-time or that won't go back to the new buyer. You had some really interesting ones that people didn't think about. I hadn't thought about. Like, for example, you had a website redesign. I had always figured that if you were going to try to sell a business, you couldn't reclaim that because people would argue, hey, that's just a regular business expense. But you made the point like, well, it depends how often you're doing that website redesign. If you're doing it once every 4 years, you can probably add back 3/4 of that website redesign. You had trademark filing was one. Talk, if you would, about reduced cost of goods sold and third-party fees, because I thought those were interesting adbacks, or any other adbacks that you think commonly get missed by people. Because as you point out, like, you know, if you miss $5,000 in adbacks, it's not $5,000 you're losing out on in the sale. It's 5 times, let's say it's a 4x multiple, $20,000, because it all flows through to the bottom line. It's a big deal.
Exactly. Yeah. If the audience, I think everybody needs to read this chapter, right? No matter how good you are. You've been doing this for a long time and you learn something just by delving into that. This is where people lose the most money, especially if they're selling on their own to a friend, relative, or an aggregator. So digest chapter 11 of this book, because it's where most people will lose money in the blink of an eye. And like you said, $5,000 is not a $5,000 loss. It's a $15,000 to $20,000 loss. Some of the things you asked me to delve into are pretty deep, but one that most people miss is an ad back for cashback points or rewards. Why? Because they usually just slide it over to their personal account and it's never on the books, especially if they do the books on their own. If they've got a professional e-commerce bookkeeper, it may be on the books. I'm starting to see it more. But I did an AMA for the acquisition lab a week before last, and I've got, 15 or 20 people, and we're just rapping for an hour and a half. And one of them, we get into that section on ad backs, and he speaks up and he goes, "Everybody, I got to tell you right now, I sold my business 3 months ago. And I was so excited to tell the owners how they could, use cashback monies. And basically, I gifted them $30,000 because I sold my business for about a 3x multiple and I got $10,000 a year in cashback. And I told them all about it and how to do it. But I didn't put it in my ad back schedule." So he was, I love pissing off people that just sold their businesses because they learn, oh shit, I didn't do that. I mean, that's $30,000. I've got a son that's going to college next year. That's a year's tuition, right? It matters.
When you think about when you go out, you've got the book, you start shopping a business to your list, to buyers, things like that. What do you, when you're helping sellers evaluate offers, how often do you see them take, I think I know the answer to this, but how often do you see them take the top price versus taking a lower offer, either with better terms or from better people? And if it's the latter, which I guess it likely is at least a good percentage of the time, what are the biggest things that those sellers that aren't offering top dollar bring to the table that allow them to buy the business for less? What are the big terms? Or I'm sure reputation is a big part of it if they're a known player or if they're not. But apart from that, which is obvious, are there any other little things? What are the big things that allow people to buy businesses for, more reasonable rates and be able to, knock off that top bidder?
I love that question. I love that question because everybody would think as a seller, you're just going to sell to the highest value. And that's not the case. It's not even, the highest value or best deal structure. It's often, you know, we've had a situation where we've had, you know, as I said, at least four offers on every listing so far this year, which means that the seller is in a situation where they can often choose their buyer. Chuck had a situation where I think he had 14 offers, right? So you immediately, what I do is every time we have a call and then I've got a buyer-seller conference call, the seller and I do a recap after and review what you liked and what you didn't like about the person first and foremost. Can you live with them through due diligence? Can you live with them through transition and training? Do we trust them? Are they going to be good to work with, or are they going to be a royal pain in the ass? And if they're going to be a royal pain in the ass, odds are, even if it's an all cash, full price offer or over asking, they're going to fall below somebody that's really, really likable. A situation where I sold a business for a guy, Syed Balki, right? A lot of people might know his name, owns a company called Opt-in Monster. I've sold three separate businesses for Syed at this point. He had a business, again, let's call it $2.5 million. I had two full price offers on the business. One was all cash from a guy that was very confident in himself, a little rough around the edges, and thought he was important, more important than he was because he could buy a business for all cash. You know, the other guy was the nicest guy in the world, did some research on Syed, realized that they both went to the same school in Florida. They're both Gator fans, had the same philosophy in terms of taking care of his people. Right. In the package, I had talked about how important his staff was and that they could carry forward with a new owner of the business. Nathan, this buyer, really honed in on that and focused on it. But Nathan was an SBA buyer and couldn't offer all cash. And it was going to take longer to close, and it wasn't totally up to him. Syed picked Nathan. So in this case, if we say the price was $2.5 million, Syed took $250,000 less at closing because the buyer was more trustworthy and likable than the all-cash buyer. Syed's fear was that the all-cash buyer was going to try to renegotiate in due diligence because he was kind of a pain in the ass on just the initial conference call, and he was too confident in himself. So likability for a buyer is really, really important. Build a relationship. It's not just grilling the seller about the business. It's getting to know them, you know, having a cordial conversation, being likable. You know, at the end of the day, if there are multiple offers, the first thing they're going to do is say, who do I like more? Okay, now which offers match up with who I like more? Deal structure is an important part of it, obviously. Everybody would like an all cash offer. But when you get into the larger businesses in the $2, $3, $4+, $5 million range, you know, buyers are going to come in with different types of deal structures, depending upon who the buyer is, of course. But all cash would be great. If you're a very likable person, all cash is going to win the deal. But if you give some upside to the seller, or you want that, right? If you want to give them an opportunity to sell the business for more than full price, and you want to do that in the form of, the aggregators call it profit sharing, but the truth is it's just an earnout. So again, good marketing. You know, you have to instill confidence in them that you can run the business really well as a buyer. But it's mostly the simple stuff, right? Sellers aren't banks. If there's going to be a seller note, it's going to be small, as in less than 20%. And it's going to be short, as in absolutely less than 3 years, hopefully no more than 12 months. And yes, it's going to be paid out monthly. And yes, the payments are going to be automatic. Nobody's chasing anybody or cashing any checks. But beyond cash, be cash and a seller note. And then there might be a holdback for training and transition. There might be the stability payment that the aggregators are doing now, which again is really just an earnout called by a different name. But there's the way to win a deal as a buyer in this market is just to be likable.
Interesting. It shouldn't be too shocking. That's pretty good advice just in life in general, but obviously it transfers over on the, yeah, with the, as the zeros start to pile up. Joe, last couple of questions for you. You mentioned in your book, you do an exit interview with all of your sellers. And I'm curious, what are the biggest things that you learn or that stands out from people after they've sold the business? You know, is it, and I'm not sure what the time frame is, if you do it like, you know, that week, or you follow up with them a couple of weeks, or maybe even a couple months later, but what kind of themes do you see on the back end once the deal is done? People are either moving on, they're retiring, they're going to a new business, and it could be feelings, it could be regrets that they had, it could be anything. What stands out in those exit interviews?
Well, one of the things I often just come right on and ask and say, how do you feel? And it's not, how do you feel about all that money in your bank account? It's, how do you feel And more often than not, whether they sold a business for $500,000 or $5 million, they feel like a great burden has been lifted off their shoulders. Right? In Mike's case, it was the imbalance of leverage, right? The business was so leveraged because there was so much inventory versus the cash flow. And it just didn't help him sleep at night. And he was like, let me get rid of this one. Let me move on to the next one, get rid of this one. But how do you feel first and foremost? And more often than not, people sell businesses not because they're going to sell and never work again. It's because they're tired, and they're tired of the struggle, and they're bored. And they need to move on. Something's changed in their life, and selling is just a burden lifted off their shoulders. Gives them some breathing room. They're out of the daily grind. They've got some money in the bank. They've got, you know, some college tuition paid for. They've got some retirement funded, and they've got some cash to live off of, plus some working capital to launch their next adventure and do it with less stress, more experience, smarter, more profitable, cheaper, all of those things. One of the things that came up almost with every single exit interview, which could be solved with a simple article, was, I wish I had a better roadmap of, you know, every step of the way in the process, Joe. And when it's easy on the outside looking in, and people might be listening, go, why didn't you just do that? Why didn't you just go step one, step two, step three, step four? Yeah, probably coulda, shoulda, woulda. But when you're in the grind, you know, carving out 4 hours or 5 hours or a week or whatever it might take to do it properly, it just takes time. So yeah, I took 2 years instead and wrote a book about it because I wanted to encapsulate everything, and I didn't want little bits and pieces to be available on different pages of a website that you had to search for. So that exit interview really led to me realizing, no matter how many blog posts people read, no matter how many podcasts they listened to, no matter how many conversations they had with me or members of my team, it still wasn't enough. They were still drinking through a fire hose, which means that there was a lot of water on the ground and they were choking. That they needed to sort of take a glass at a time and absorb this information at their own pace, at their own time, so they could just sort of think about their own eventual exit, hence all of the details in the book. So I think I've encapsulated, you know, the process that people needed in that exit interview in the book. We go from initial, don't do this, this is what so-and-so did and it was foolish, this is what so-and-so did and it was brilliant, all the way through to, you know, asset purchase agreements, training and transition, and what you do after the fact. But the key thing for me, oddly enough, Andrew, is when I or anybody on my team is invested in helping somebody sell their most valuable asset, which is their business, it's important to us that we're building a relationship with them. And it doesn't end when the transaction closes and money hits the bank. We want it to continue. So there's that exit interview and then checking in, and whether it's in a month or 2 months or 3 months or 6 months, or excited to see them at the next event.
Fantastic. Just finished it up. Like I said, highly recommend it if you're thinking about selling, but even if you're not, if you've got a business, just a great way to prep your business for sale at any time, because it's often the businesses that are ready to sell are the ones that are oftentimes also the easiest to run. So great book, Joe. Really well done. Where can people pick it up? Amazon, of course. Anywhere else that people can find it, or that you prefer that they go get it if they're interested?
Yeah, they can grab it at exitpreneur.io if they could figure out how to spell exitpreneur. I spelled it wrong for the first time, and I had the .com. I was so excited. I spelled it wrong. And people have trouble saying it. You know, I think I surveyed you and another 9 or 10 people that I trust in the space, and the choice between the two book covers were Incredible Exits or Exitpreneur. And I think 9 of you said Incredible Exits. So of course I chose the Exitpreneur playbook. But yeah, exitpreneur.io or right on Amazon, you can do a search for it there as well.
Great. And we'll look up that in the show notes, but it's pretty easy to find. So available on Kindle as well, which is a great way I love reading business books on Kindle because I just love the highlight functionality. You can go back in about 20 minutes, recap all the important stuff. So it's a great way to do it. But Joe, congrats on the book. Thank you for coming on, sharing all this stuff. Obviously, you know this just about as well as anybody. And yeah, thanks for being just a great partner for ECF with over the years. Go back to Nashville, like you mentioned at the top. And it's been just a pleasure, man, being in this crazy e-commerce journey with you and the team over there. So yeah, appreciate you coming on and for everything over the years. Thank you, sir.
Likewise. Thanks for all the support over the years. Appreciate you having me on.
Thanks so much for listening. And the fact that you made it to the end of the episode tells me you're probably someone interested in this stuff and might be a really good fit for the e-commerce fuel community. Our community is the world's largest group of 7- and 8-figure e-commerce store owners and offers a value-packed form, dynamic live events, and much more. If that sounds interesting at all, you should learn about membership and how to apply at ecommercefuel.com. Big thank you to our two sponsors. Supercharge your email marketing efforts with Klaviyo, the world's best email and SMS marketing engine at klaviyo.com/ECF. And also one-click upsell from Zipify Apps, where you can rapidly increase your average order value by offering powerful targeted upsells. You can get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Finally, thanks to Sherelle Torrecampo for helping produce the show. Work hard, adventure often, and looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
This is the ASY Radio Network live from New York.